Welcome to In the Studio with 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Album.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's part two of The Essential Lynyrd Skynyrd. Mr. Saturday Night Special.
Back when Ronnie was alive when I was in the band, he told me many times that, he said, man, he said, one day soon I'm going to get out of this business, and he said, I'm just going to sit back and write the tunes, and my brother's going to be here singing them. He said it many times. Give me back my
bullets. That's one of the reasons I keep on going, because that's what happens with this band here now. Sometimes we'll be hitting the note, so to speak, you know, hitting it and going, and I forget all the, I hate to say shit, but all the stuff that happened with the old band, the bad luck and troubles and just the, you know, the blues we had and the tragedies, you know, and it all goes away with this because we're going on and the feelings are there from, I know Alan and Ronnie and Stevie and all of them are looking down on us with grins. I know this in my heart.
Hi, this is Ed King of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
I'm Johnny Van Zandt.
And I'm Gary Rossin of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Watching a 1975 English TV appearance by Lynyrd Skynyrd on the popular program Old Grey Whistle Test saw the three-guitar army minus one lead guitarist, Ed King, who had quit midway through the notorious Torture Tour. Original producer Al Kooper also had bailed out. A powerful new drummer, Artemis Pyle, had replaced founding member Bob Burns. And the soulful gals who would later install a swing on Skynyrd's musical back porch, the Honkettes, they had yet to be added. So with the exception of Billy Powell on grand piano, that whistle test performance reveals Lynyrd Skynyrd in the configuration identical to their formative neighborhood carport band. Lead singer and lyricist Ronnie Van Zandt's performance that day seemed a little flat, his demeanor subdued, maybe even troubled. Whether it was simply jet lag, the prim and proper British TV studio experience, or a real concern for the band's depleted ranks and immediate future, we'll never know. But this is most evident. The musicianship of lead guitarist Alan Collins and Gary Rossington, bass player and harmony vocalist Leon Wilkeson, along with the aforementioned Billy Powell and Artemis Pyle, the musicianship was white hot, tightly rehearsed, and perfectly executed. Even as the band found fame and fortune abroad, Lynyrd Skynyrd co-founder guitarist Gary Rossington explains that lead singer-lyricist Ronnie Van Zandt found it hard to outrun his own shadow back home in Jacksonville, Florida. Here is Gary, followed by the late Lynyrd Skynyrd bass player Leon Wilkeson.
He just always felt like he was an outlaw because being from the west side of town and fighting and the reputation he had in the early days was like an outlaw. And then, I don't know, we were just kind of the bad boys in Jacksonville, and a lot of people didn't like us. And then when disco came in, like he says in the song about the pretty boys and their disco shoes and stuff, that was in our era in this early 70s and stuff. That was disco versus rock was a big thing, so yeah. We hated it. And all the bands and all the record stations, and you remember this, was playing disco and not us. So we really hated them, and he just kind of, that was Jacksonville. They hated us in the disco days because we were a southern rock band with long hair and showing up at these clubs and dance places like that, and they were dancing and doing Dance Fever, you know, Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
It wasn't mixing, so he just kind of wrote his feelings down like that. But he felt like that, I'm sure, yeah. He always did.
Yeah, I'll never forget hearing about when Gary and Ronnie were going to approach Alan about joining the band. The story I heard, he was riding his bicycle, and they were driving a car, and he was hauling tail on that bike because he thought Ronnie was going to beat him up.
Yeah, we had to chase him up a tree that day.
Get him to join the band.
Threw his bike down and ran out in the woods and climbed an oak tree. And we had to call him down from this tree, swearing we weren't going to hurt him. We just wanted to talk.
Originally from Lynyrd Skynyrd's third album in March 1975, called Nothing Fancy, that's Saturday Night Special, rock's first anti-handgun song, a socially progressive statement from the band that had just immortalized segregationist Governor George Wallace in Sweet Home Alabama. With Nothing Fancy's release in spring 1975, Lynyrd Skynyrd was a major headliner, but the nonstop touring, hard drinking, and brawling was beginning to take a toll. Original drummer Bob Burns buckled under the strain while Lynyrd Skynyrd toured England, and he was replaced by Artemus Pyle. And during the notorious 1975 Torture Tour, as it became known, guitarist Ed King left abruptly after a series of fist fights following their Pittsburgh show.
We were definitely at the road's end then, and we were kind of burnt out and tired and not really knowing what we were going to do, you know. And then we had, of course, changed producers from Cooper to Dowd, and it was a lot of big change. And I don't know, times were changing at that time. You know, all the southern groups were kind of dying out and going to the half of them were the Almonds and Marshall Tucker and Charlie Dan, all of them were kind of gone. Either broke up or split up or not doing any good. We were like the only group left from the South before the new generation of the Hatchets and the 38s and stuff came along. It was like the end of a time, really. It was that time and the time when Ed left, and we were just kind of at the road's end, like I say.
Lynyrd Skynyrd's On the Hunt comes from the third album, 1975's Nothing Fancy, one of six original albums that have been collected in a handsome box containing remastered sound, pressed on premium heavy audiophile vinyl, and wrapped in original artwork. It's in stores and online now. Next, the boys from the cabin on McGurd's Creek face their first major defections from the simpler, innocent times. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, at Redbeard Rocks, and online at InTheStudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Gary Rossington and Ed King for some of the essential best of Lynyrd Skynyrd Part 2.
Hi, I'm Gary Rossington, in the studio from Lynyrd Skynyrd.
In September of 1975, the next studio album was begun, this time with a different producer, veteran Tom Dowd, and at a different studio. Gary Rossington and Leon Wilkerson explain why Gimme Back My Bullets sounds so different than the first three Lynyrd Skynyrd albums.
Yeah, I think Bullets was just a time we were changing producers, and it was just Alan and myself on guitars. Ed was gone, and it was just a kind of a rushed record we had to do and making at Capricorn. We were kind of rushed. We were touring and doing that record at the same time as touring. It was just a hard one. And
that was the least successful album. We were just facing like a run into a brick wall kind of thing. But the songs are great on her, but like Gary's saying, you know, it was just him and Alan in the guitar part. So I think it was real noticeable that three-guitar distinction was kind of missing on that album.
Smokin' from the live double album One More from the Road. That's Lynyrd Skynyrd with the definitive version of Gimme Back My Bullets. By 1976, Lynyrd Skynyrd decided to fill the open third guitarist slot with unknown Oklahoma guitarist Steve Gaines, brother of backing singer Cassie Gaines. And because Gimme Back My Bullets was loaded with blanks, Lynyrd Skynyrd decided quickly on a stopgap measure, recording a live album at Atlanta's Fox Theater. Here's Gary Rossington and Leon Wilkerson.
Well, I remember back then, and I guess still today, you have to do a certain many albums or CDs that you're signed to with a record company. And we had, and those days, we had to do a record each year. Ed King had just quit, and we'd just gotten Steve, and it was time to do a new record. So instead of not stopping for anything and continuing to tour and trying to write a record that we weren't ready for, we just decided to do a live one. And with Tom Dowd, he'd just done Give Me Back My Bullets with us. We thought that we had the perfect guy because his record would do it, you know, track record of doing live records. So we wanted to do it live to show people what we sounded like live, that we weren't like a band. A lot of bands back in those days would sound real good in the studio, but in a live, when you heard them, they would be terrible. same as today, I guess. And so we wanted to show everybody that live what we sounded like.
Steve Gaines was just getting worked into the band then, too. He hadn't been with us a long
time.
No,
and a lot of songs he didn't know. He was only with us a week or two. And he had to sit out in my living room.
I remember.
He had to sit out and then turn his guitar down and fake like he was playing. And he didn't even play on a few songs, and then some he did play that he knew, you know. Well, he hadn't learned them. He could have played and jammed on them, but we weren't that kind of band. We wanted it tight. So we made him turn his guitar down. We didn't want him to look goofy, so we just said, pretend like you're playing if you don't know it, but turn your damn guitar down. And he kind of would laugh, and he'd act like he was playing away with his guitar down. And that's then the one songs he knew, he'd play with us, and he did some solos and everything, but it was really kind of funny, you know.
Yeah, he got enough in there to be noticed, and it wasn't long before Ronnie would be telling the audience to watch out, he'd sick Oki on him. Mm-hmm. God bless Steve Gaines, man.
One of the biggest inspirations to the teenage members of the original Carport Band was Cream's final farewell concert tour in 1968, which played in Miami. The starry-eyed teenagers and what would become Lynyrd Skynyrd were determined to see their heroes, but guitarist Gary Rossington and bass player Leon Wilkinson, in his final radio interview before his death in July 2001, reminded me that all but one of the Lynyrd Skynyrd members were poor as church mice back then.
We used to always collect Coke bottles and pop bottles to get guitar strings or pay for gas to get, you know, around town. But for that particular...
it was a survival tactic.
Yeah, that particular time, besides tickets and gas, you know, we had to get a little food and stuff. So we all collected Coke bottles for two or three or four days, just driving around and walking around and riding our bikes around back then, looking for bottles and collecting them. And you'd cash them in for 3 cents a bottle, you know.
Yeah. And our meals mostly contained of RC Colas and Moon Pies. Yeah.
That's the way we used to change guitar strings. Alan and I and Leon, we'd always go collect Coke bottles. You'd get about 10 or 15 Coke bottles, and you could buy a new set of strings, see?
Next, Skynyrd rides the momentum of the live album back into the studio and delivers their finest album in their history, only to have the Free Bird fall out of the sky. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, the gripping first-hand account from Gary Rossington, next, in the studio for The Essential Lynyrd Skynyrd Part 2.
Hi, I'm Johnny Van Zandt.
And I'm Gary Rossington, Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Welcome back in the studio for The Essential Lynyrd Skynyrd Part 2. I'm Redbeard, and I remember a People magazine feature around September 1977, just before the release of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Street Survivors album, showing a cleaned-up, healthy, even muscular Ronnie Van Zandt with his kids on a swing set, talking about sobriety and fatherhood and a year spent off the road, concentrating on quality of life issues while attempting to write quality songs again. Lynyrd Skynyrd guitarist Gary Rossington feels that the addition of guitarist Steve Gaines at that time helped, too, in a number of ways.
Just adding Steve to the band, and by then he was really a part of the band, so to speak. He had been with us for a few months, almost a year after, you know, the 2 weeks we got him before the live album. It had been almost a year passed before Street Survivors, and so he was like a member of the band.
By the time you went in to record.
Yeah, by the time, and he had wrote two or three of the songs,
good
and
point.
We had got with him. He was singing some, and we'd known him, and we'd lived with him. You know, we knew him. Finished year in England and Japan and all these, you know, Germany and France and all that, and we sold out everywhere. We were selling out everywhere we went, and everything we did went gold and platinum and stuff. We were doing real good. It was like the height of our career. We were kind of labeled just as... journalists and stuff did. They labeled us America's Rolling Stones, you know. But actually, we were selling more records and selling out more crowds than they did. You know, we were doing better than them, I mean, statistically and stuff. But we were doing real good. At the time, I guess we were about the biggest band around at that. Right then, you know, I mean, there was a million bands around as good or better than us, but we were just really doing good then when it ended. But I don't know, it's a lot of things that led up to that made us do that, you know, and we just was a working band. We just tried to be the best we could anytime and still are, you know. The best we can do is what we try.
What's Your Name from October 1977's Street Survivors. The album had been out less than a week when the band set out on tour in a private charter plane. Lead singer Ronnie Van Zant, guitarist Steve Gaines, and his sister, backup singer Cassie, the pilot and co-pilot of the plane, and Lynyrd Skynyrd road manager Dean Kilpatrick, all would not return. Here's Gary Rossington.
He was really our everything guy. You know, he did everything for us. He was our friend from day one, and he was like our only roadie for years, and valet and friend and everything, you know, like I say. And then Cassie and Steve, you know, that was real bad that they both went, you know. Actually, at the time of the crash, it was the only people who died were right up front, and it was Dean and me and Ronnie. I was in between Ronnie and Dean, and the other side was Steve and Cassie, and Alan was in between them.
And so there were it was three on each side of the aisle?
Up front. And me and Alan were in between all four people that died, so we always, you know, it's extra heavy to us that we were right there and we didn't die, and they did, but, you know, that's just fate and whatever. But
how badly were you injured?
Oh, real bad. I got scars all over me. I had all my bones, not all of them, but just about all of them broke. Both legs and both wrists and both arms, upper arms and wrists, and my pelvic bone and all my ribs and my feet, and I don't know, just some millions of things. Everything was broke.
I hear we technically lost you for a
while. Oh, yeah,
I was gone.
I don't remember being gone. Or like people die and come back, and they, you know, I don't remember. I just was so hurt. I was kind of dead for a while. But Leon died, and they, revived him. He was dead about a minute and a half, pronounced, you know, had no pulse. And I don't think I had one for, I don't think it was that long for me. I think it was like seconds for me, but I don't remember that. I don't remember dying and going to heaven and coming back. But it's heavy. You know, I got to laugh at times because it's so heavy. If you don't laugh, you cry.
Well, sure.
You know?
And I'm leading up to that. And I got one, and I'm sorry to take you through this.
No. I'm here.
Was there a storm? Why did the plane crash? What?
Actually, there was a malfunction in the right engine and the coupling, and it leaked all the gas out, and we ran out of gas. We had a full tank, or two engines. We had two full tanks, and during the flight, one engine, you run off one tank until it's gone, then you throw a crossover switch in that plane, and you use the other tank.
Mm-hmm.
So we were using one tank of gas for both engines, and the other spare tank was leaking the whole time. It was just dripping gas this whole hour and a half we were up in the air. And so when the tank they were using was down to empty, they threw that switch, and it went over to an empty tank. So the second they threw that switch, we went straight down. And it wasn't their fault. It was their fault for not knowing that happened, I guess, but nobody's fault.
Yeah.
Of course they didn't do that because they died. You know, it was just a bad accident. But that's the reason. It ran out of gas. Just simple, ran out of gas, and it's a shame, you know.
In 1987, a tribute tour to mark the 10th anniversary of the plane crash reunited the Lynyrd Skynyrd survivors, plus Ed King, at Charlie Daniels' Volunteer Jam on Labor Day weekend. Alan Collins was in a wheelchair due to injuries he sustained in a car crash. On vocals was the youngest Van Zant brother, Johnny. Ed King maintains that Ronnie Van Zant had predicted it long ago.
Back when Ronnie was alive, when I was in the band, he told me many times that, he said, man, he said, one day soon I'm going to get out of this business. And he said, I'm just going to sit back and write the tunes, and my brother's going to be here singing them. He said it many times.
Here's Gary Rossington with current Lynyrd Skynyrd singer, Johnny Van Zant.
Sometimes we'll be hitting the note, so to speak, you know, hitting it and going, and I forget all the, I hate to say but all the stuff that happened with the old band, the bad luck and troubles and just the, you know, the blues we had and the tragedies, you know, and it all goes away with this because we're going on and the feelings are there from, I know Alan and Ronnie and Stevie and all of them are looking down on us with grins. I know this in my heart. I think I know, but as with Johnny's the only other person who would have to feel it that deep that it's all right to do this, you know, from his brother. But I feel it, and I know it's all right. But anyway, I feel this. It's like all the old stuff didn't happen, and this is so good and new and fresh, and it's kind of like we deserve it because we had so much bad that, man, and just to play music, you know, that's the only payback we want, you know. But, that's a real good way to explain it.
I tell you, that is the truth, though. I mean, with me, myself, I mean, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't believe that Ronnie would want me to do it.
Yeah.
Not at all. Because I got to die one day, and I wouldn't want him to meet me up there kicking my butt. I loved him, man. He was my brother, and gosh, man, I wouldn't do it for no other reason but those reasons. And again,
it's like Johnny said earlier, I don't compare us even with the old band because we are different and new. But we can play the old stuff as good or better, you know, as the old, you know, because I played it with them and, you know, but the new stuff is in its own way is as good or better, so to speak. And I'm real happy with that. And it really takes away from all the old hurt.
In the studio, when half a band dies in a plane crash, while the remainder is so critically injured that their hearts stop in the emergency room, you don't expect to see their name pop up on an album release schedule or tour itinerary. So imagine my astonishment and trepidation when Lynyrd Skynyrd's former record company summoned me in early 1980 to interview Gary Rossington and Alan Collins, still visibly scarred from the plane crash less than 3 years earlier, wanted me to talk to them about a new band with survivor Leon Wilkeson called the Rossington Collins Band. The resolve that Gary and Alan both exhibited then was truly heroic. First, Gary Rossington.
We could retire and loaf around all the time, but this is our life, and we never learn how to quit. And I don't know how to do nothing else but pick strawberries, and I'd rather play. And, you know, I like to please the people. That's what it's all about. And let them forget the blues for an hour or two when we're playing. And their house payments and their wife broke up with them, and you know, we knew we had to go on. And that came from a lot of help from the beautiful people out there who wrote and got us back inspired and not quitting but going on. And our friends that are over the rainbow had something to do with that, you know. I feel other people on stage. I feel the presence of other people with us. So it's just not the people you see. We got a lot of help from our friends that are gone, but they ain't really gone.
In 1980, I asked guitarist Alan Collins why he'd risk his fragile health after the trauma of the plane crash, exposing himself to press sensationalism and even some morbid fans, plus the inevitable musical comparisons that would arise with the Rossington Collins Band.
I'll say that real fast. The reason not to is the reason to do it. One of those things where people tell you not to do something, and you want to do it, and you know you can do it, then you do it. And you don't play around, you don't mess around about it, you just do it, you know. Because we're winners, not losers. And we will do it again.
Me and Ronnie, we used to bass fish all the time. Lots of times, Lacey'd have to take us because we didn't have a way to get there. And we had an old John boat, but we'd have to use his white station wagon to carry us down to the fishing hole. Anyway, Johnny was a little kid then, and we couldn't cuss or talk about girls or...
Johnny.
We were only 16, 17 at that time.
But you were men of the world.
Yeah, we were men of the world, and you know, we couldn't talk about girls or cuss, or we couldn't even, you know, or we'd say shit or something, and Lacey go, "Don't be cussing, Johnny's over there," you know. And then we used to make it, try to leave him home, not go fishing with us so we could cuss and talk about girls.
Have some fun. Have some fun, right?
Yeah, but no, he was just, you know, he was just a kid, and Lacey... You know, he's the daddy of all the Van Zandt boys. He used to tell he was going to keep Johnny good, and he wanted him to be, first of all, smart, and second of all, not hanging out with us.
You made out good on the first thing.
Leon Wilkeson talking about opening night of the 1987 tribute tour.
And I'm facing the van, and out of the corner of my eye, I see something fluttering on the ground. And I looked over, and it was a little sparrow. I thought it had a broken wing. So my intent was to go and check the bird out, going to carry it in and get someone to take it to a, you know, a veterinarian or something, try to save it. And I gently lifted it up in my hands, figured I had a broken wing. And there was some kind of a black thread-like thing wrapped around its leg. It wasn't a piece of string. It wasn't a piece of thread. It was like a piece of moss or something. Like I've never seen, you know. It's a weird bush. And I remember when it was fluttering, there was like a branch off this bush that was pulling, you know, with the bird. It, you know, every time the bird flapped around, the limb moved in perfect, you know, sync with it. When I lifted the bird and realized this thread was on there, I realized it was attached to this limb, and I popped it, and the bird just went pew, like a bullet. And that was a strange experience for me for the first night Johnny sang the words to Freebird.
And when I watched them on the final morning of that tour, hugging goodbye to each other, the emotions were so powerful that I wondered how they could let the Lynyrd Skynyrd legacy go and let it pass on into history. Here's Gary Rossington and Johnny Van Zandt.
Lots of us were together for the first time in years and years, and we thought at that time that would be the last time we'd see each other. Even Johnny and me, yeah. We thought that, you know, it'd be all over. It was just going to, we were going to do that tour and quit. So it was real emotional and saying goodbye, a lot of tears. And
I think that's probably the reason how come we're here today, though, because of that morning, because it's like, you know, man, how can you give that up?
We didn't want to quit.
You couldn't give it up. I mean, that night was so great there, and, you know, and the whole tour was so great. Is that what really, that's what really kept us together, you know, to even go back out after that. We were like, well, I don't know, we don't want to cop out, you know, this was supposed to be a tribute tour, you know, this is all we were supposed to do.
Well, the audience,
you know, and,
too.
But the audiences were so great, man, it was like, how can you walk away from that?
Former Lynyrd Skynyrd guitarist Ed King.
We didn't believe it was over. I mean, like, it wasn't that we were in disbelief. It's just like we looked at each other and said, this ain't over. And really not that we were going to go out. I mean, we did go out and do a second leg of the tribute tour, but several of us had a feeling that, no, this ain't over. There's more to this than the tribute tour.
You know, we just thought that, you know, Ronnie had been awful proud of him, you know, smiling down from heaven, going, go for it, little brother, you know, do it, do it. And Johnny did it. He did what he was called to do.
I honestly feel we couldn't have gotten this far without him. And he doesn't knock anybody's teeth out in the band.
Well, of course he helps. Of course he helps keep that Skynyrd sound, too, you know. You know, I don't like to compare him to Ronnie. Nobody, he doesn't like to be compared to Ronnie, and we don't like to compare him to Ronnie, but, you know, he does give us still that good old Southern sound. He worked. It worked.
You know, the fans keep the faith in us. That's what it's about. But I'm amazed every day, and it blows my mind even more lately, because since we started this, you know, since the record's been done and we've been talking about going out and everything, it's just every day, you know, it's, we're into what we're doing more now is what I'm saying, instead of not doing the band, we are now. And gosh, there's so many dedicated fans, and their kids are fans, and there's new ones, and their mothers are fans, you know, and it's humbling. I mean,
I think just for me being an outsider too, you know, and being a fan of Lynyrd Skynyrd before ever, like I said, you know, thought about
dreamed,
yeah, dreamed of being with the band. I was still there 10 years later. I was still keeping the faith, you know, myself. I was still listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd up until, you know, they asked me to come and sing with the band. I'm as a fan too. I'm a fan of Lynyrd Skynyrd. So I think for me, you know, looking at it that way, if we would have never done this, I would have still been there 20 years from that time. But I think the thing with Skynyrd is that it's kind of like the Stones and Zeppelin and, you know, and the Almonds. You know, there's that following there. It's real stuff. It's the roots of rock and roll.
The Southern pride that, you know, I haven't been through everything we've been through, and knowing that we still have the availability and opportunity. And still can do it, you know. It's
what we do best, and what we love the best too, you know.
We know we can't do it all our lives, you know. Eventually, we're going to be too old to do it. So, I think, and the music that we're creating, it's just still there, and I can't leave it. I can't give up. I can't think of anything else I'd rather do.
From Lynyrd Skynyrd's Street Survivors, one of six original albums that have been collected in a handsome box containing remastered sound, pressed on premium heavy audiophile vinyl, and wrapped in original artwork. It's in stores and online now. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all of my guests of Lynyrd Skynyrd, past and present. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter, Brunei. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, @RedbeardRocks, and online at inthestudio.net.